On Sunday afternoon, November 7th, the First Unitarian Church in Oakland, California, was filled to capacity with friends and comrades of Marilyn Buck. They had come together to celebrate her life and to honor her fellow political prisoners for whose cause she struggled. This is the second of a three-part recording of the spoken words and music from that afternoon. We begin this segment with a voice of another former prisoner, Ida McCrae, now director of Families with a Future. She's speaking of her friendship with Marilyn and reading one of her poems. She then introduces her grandson, Tyree, who reads his own poem for Marilyn. Then you will hear David Meltzer, poet, teacher, and friend to Marilyn, who reads another of her poems. He was followed by the a cappella singing group Finesse, featuring Wardell Potts. Then came one of the more moving features of that dramatic afternoon, a 9-minute video clip made of Marilyn in 1989, of which you will hear the audio. This segment will conclude with a loving recollection of Marilyn by her longtime friend and lawyer, Sophia Elijah, who was with Marilyn when she died at the apartment they shared in Brooklyn during her 3 weeks of freedom. She will begin by reading a message from Asada Shakur. She will end by introducing a voice message from Asada that will open the third and final part of the program. And now let's begin with Ida McCrae.
For a lot of sadness, I'm here. And when I saw those pictures, it just tore me apart. It was hard to look at because of my love for Marilyn and remembering. And as you see in some of the pictures, we had some fun together. I started to write some and said, I knew her a little. And then I said, she was like a diamond, you know. All the different prisons were her interest, her knowledge, and her loves. And I found out more about her when we sat around. I think we was at Donna's house. Where's Donna? Where you at? You saw so many other prisons of who Marilyn truly was. And I'm like, wow, I thought I knew you. But one of the things is that Marilyn loved black people. People that don't even like black people. She wasn't one of those white women who was patronizing you in a shoe fit wear. She wasn't patronizing. She wasn't saying, I better get one on my board because it won't look right. She wasn't one of those type of white women who walked around and said, well, let's see if we can put somebody up in here so it look like we're nice and liberal. Marilyn loved black people. I thought I was her body worker. Besides, you know, we did the clay thing together, and we made a beautiful piece of chess for my son, who at 12 years old was playing chess all over Berkeley. And in that, we sat together and made a lot of pieces. She loved children, and just so happened yesterday, I wasn't even trying this, but it just I ran into a poem that I bet you don't have, of Marilyn. Now, this is one of those type of poems where you got to really think about, and I know somebody's recording this for the FBI and everybody else, so maybe you can read the poem and it'll change your heart, okay? It's called Skin Dance, so just give me extra reading, because this is a draft. Skin covers the drum, gives hollow space purpose, voice. Without skin, there is no sound, no vibration, no rhythm. Without rhythm, the heart ceases, gives way, then silence. Frayed, the drum is no drum, just a trunk, an open-ended tunnel through which many shapes slither. Without substance, snakes of sound. Shred skins, vulnerable in that moment, sidewinder slink beyond touch. Shifting sands, burnished scales, brilliant, mesmerizing. Beautiful skin, young, sensuous, aged skin made sear by summer storms, winter freeze, erotic timber steel. Firm flesh, pale brushes, seasoned thigh ignites brush fire. I had soft skin, Ida used to say. I laughed at her obsession. My laughter softened at her healing touch yesterday. I walk across the yard, the sun strokes my arms, tattoos, tremors on flesh, no longer flesh, still supple, cradles for the heartbeat, satin, bone, arpeggios sing, spirit pulse in thin skin temples, blue veins, flush, lacerated. Flesh lies open, wounds weep, blood notes across the frontier. 1 millimeter beyond silken desire in carmine streams, hemorrhage. Can't she write? God damn. Ooh-wee. Oh, excuse me, I'm not supposed to say in church. That sister again, right. I want to close with a poem by my grandson, Tyre. Call to the people! All right.
What's your name again? A poem for Marilyn Buck. Marilyn Buck bucked the system until one day she won. Marilyn Buck did her best and now her job is done. Viva Marilyn.
Viva Marilyn! Viva Marilyn! Viva the spirit of Marilyn! May she live on.
The next to speak was David Meltzer.
So incredibly touched by all of this, I had the great joy of being one of Marilyn's long-distance teachers with Graciela. We were teaching at a place called, what was it? New College of California. Enough said. But an alumni. And it was a very unusual setup because obviously we were in the Mission District and she was in Dublin. So thanks to this wonderful person who worked at New College called Tom Parsons, who was also, you know, yes, a great friend of Marilyn's. We were able to audio cassette classes, mail them to her. She would listen to them, and then whatever assignment there was, she would mail back to us. Felix, Miranda, and I would visit her regularly. Graciela had a different situation as a teacher. She was able to go in and actually they could do study together. And that waiting room, you know, that we've all been in, I just, you know, to me that's one of the most moving places on the planet. I don't know if you know, you've got all these food vending machines there, and everybody furtively, you know, eating food. But then there's the other thing. There's the children that are there. The thing that, you know, everyone had a glorious time, but it was when everyone left, when all of the women inmates were put on one side of the wall in those tan uniforms, and then all of us civilians were lined up waiting to be released, which is ironic. I don't know why, but it's just... it was overwhelming to see people, like, you know, waving to each other, crying, and so forth. Every time, that was a thing more than Marilyn's great vivacity and intelligence and just great energy. That was what I also took home with me, and how she could maintain that incredible spirit just humbled me, you know, and that's tough. All right, look. you know, this book that's coming out quite possibly is going to be published by City Lights, and it's going to be like a selected poems, and we've worked hard on it. Felix Miranda, now Jack Hirschman has jumped in and has been actually the person who's been the liaison between us and them and the publishing. So this is a poem by Marilyn. It's on that wonderful CD called Wild Poppies. And in a way, now I don't know what a typical Marilyn poem is, actually. You know, after going through so many of her poems now for how many months has it been? Like a year, maybe? I don't know. And this one I would have said in my professorial bilge that this was like atypical. But now I don't know. Anyway, this is called Revelation. This is a time when the world seeks revelation. Too many seek that which is not but illusion or reassurance. Those who thirst for visions drink hallucinations. The future perfect tense belongs to charlatans. Pied pipers lead the future into deceptions. Poisoned seas, cataclysms, punishments, hell, damnation, all mirages of souls in anguish, salvation for the elect. They fear themselves and the echoes of mountain tombs. Do you see demons in desolation? Hear sounds of screams, wailing? Or smell sulfur burn behind your tongue, a taste of wormwood and aloes? Or encounter the touch as a torch upon the skin? You imagine fire, but it might be ice. Hounds of hell, horses pounding, hoofs are ancient. They tread through all the tales. Children who do not ripen on the vine, cling and hide beneath the bitter leaves, composting hatred of the world. Their ears stop to the sweet sounds of ascension blown by trains of quotidian toilers, artists of the ordinary. Their eyes shut before the flesh of their own desire, they name it decadence. Hell for defiant revelers. They singe the air with sanctimony and light bonfires beneath the feet of nonconformity, flaming lovers' deserts for mordant palates. Demons race upon their tongues, salty toads ready to leap into hyssop-broomed allegories. They reproach those who dare lay among the lilies of the field. Do you see? Do you see the light that flirts on willow leaves fallen in the stream? Do you hear the universe sounding in a Robeson basso tremor? Or smell the fragrance of the unsought kiss? Or cry when the moon washes silken on your skin? Do you taste dandelions dressed in orange and olive's coat? For you, no religious processionals, apocalypse, no final reckoning. The day discovers itself, opens opal prospects. Sweat drops from the brow, a stream mysterious unto itself. Red is vermilion, green is emerald, commingled dissolution into mud, the prism flawed by the acid mire of doomsday incantations. All you do not know is of a different globe. Rejoice! You will not go there. You circle not that realm. Ignore false prophets. Find mysteries for yourself. Apocalyptic chanters sing sadomasochistic fantasies for those who live on surfaces and beg for fancy trinkets, fanciful proof of a perfect spirit. Calamity follows the radiant day. Would you know stillness without the rolling of the seas? You shall glimpse that you do not know in the sound of the cedars in the night and children weeping. in the smell of the rain and taste of drought, in the breath of longing upon your breast, and in the sight of bodies strewn across ravaged landscapes. Do not be blind to the longitudes of the world. Embrace the latitudes and all they offer. Disown fear to live tomorrow. Seek not revelations. All is revealed. Listen to each word, a world in orbit, each phrase, a nova, essay, the beach, each grain of sand, a poem. Thank you. Thank you, and thank Marilyn, please, you know, bless her soul, yes.
That was poet David Meltzer. He was followed by Wardell Potts and Finesse.
Good evening. How y'all doing? When they tell you that I don't love you,
pay your attention.
When they tell you that I don't care,
pay no attention.
Don't believe in what they say. As for me, it can only be one way, and I've got a heart full of love. I've got a heart full of love. I've got a heart full of love for you. Sometimes I'm so sad and I'm blue. I don't know what to do. But I keep telling myself, yeah, that for me there can be no one else. And I've got a heart full of love. I've got a heart full of love. I've got a heart full of love for you. You. I've been trying so hard to find a way back to your heart. But I can't win, no matter how I try. I can't win. I just can't win. I can't win. When your love, I gave you my heart and gave you my soul. Instead of taking it, keeping it, you tore it apart. Now I can't win, Lord have mercy. I can't win, I just can't win. I can't win when your love. Now I go to church every Sunday, and I work hard, Lord have mercy, starting on Monday. But I can't win, no matter how I try. I can't win. I just can't win. I can't win. Win your love. I gave you my heart. And gave you my soul. Instead of taking it, keeping it, you tore it apart. Now I can't win,
no matter how I try.
I can't win, I just can't win. I can't win, win your love. When your love, when your love. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you, Finesse. That was really, really beautiful. Next, we have a video clip of Marilyn that was shot around 1989 during the resistance conspiracy trials. As you could imagine, it was very difficult to get footage of Marilyn because prison censorship did not really allow for very much videotaping over the years, and hers was really a voice that they were not very happy to have out here. So so we're happy to have a little bit of Marilyn on video. So this is, again, from 1989.
When I was 19 years old, I was living in Chicago, and I was co-editing New Left Notes out of the National Students for Democratic Society office. And we had heard about this beautiful wall called the Freedom Wall on Chicago's South Side, painted by black people representing the black struggle. So we decided it would be really nice to have this picture in the newspaper. So I and this other young woman, young white woman, we went down to the South Side of Chicago. No, and we got out of the car and I took the pictures, and this young black woman came up to me and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm taking a picture, I'm from SDS." You know, she says, "Who the hell is SDS? I don't care. Who, what are you doing in our community? Who gives you the right to come rip off our art?" And we got into a small back and forth because I was shocked. Sort of, you know, I couldn't comprehend it at that moment. And it was resolved. I gave the film back to her, and I went back. And it took me maybe a year to really understand about that people have a right to their culture. They have a right to invite you into their house, you know, and that I, even though I was a white radical, that I thought that I, you know, because I was a radical, that they gave me a passport to go anywhere without permission was a wrong thing. And it taught me a lesson about how do you respect other peoples. And I'm really happy. I'm fortunate that happened to me at that point, because I think that in the long run, though I didn't understand it the next day, that it enabled me from out of my own personal experience to understand what does it mean, self-determination, people's right to their own culture, and a right to control their own destiny. If you believe in human rights, then you have to believe, then I believe in the liberation of all peoples and people's right to their own nations, the right to their culture, to their land, to their resources. I do not believe that women can be liberated unless societies are liberated, until there are different social structures, until the means of production are controlled by the people who do the producing. And that means women. That means men, and that means whole nations. And therefore, I feel as a woman, my liberation is tied to the liberation of all the women in the world and all oppressed people and exploited peoples in the world. I think revolution and freedom is about giving life to our creativity and our spirit as human beings, irregardless of race or nationality. And I don't think that it cannot grow when one is in an oppressor situation or an oppressed situation. But on the other hand, as a revolutionary, I want to be part of a process which creates the basis for all people to live well. I don't think revolution is about trying to make everyone equally poor. I think it's about making everyone able to have the kind of comforts of society, to be able to be fulfilled in their work, and to be able to see the fruits of their labor. Well, I came of age in a period of revolution when armed struggle was being successfully employed by the Vietnamese, that revolution was in Latin America. Che Guevara was struggling in Bolivia along with many other people whose names we know and we don't know, men and women. And I always, one of the things that I learned from that was that I really believed in the question of two, three, many Vietnams. And the Black liberation struggle was really beginning to flower in this country, being able to assert itself. The question of not only self-defense, but being able to fight back, being able to take on the state in certain kinds of way. From a mass not organized level of insurrections in Detroit, in Watts, in Chicago, in Newark, to more organized forms of struggle. And one of the things that really impressed me was when I met young men and women from the Black Panther Party, and the kind of being in this organization and fighting for the liberation of their people and not having the fear, having the moral courage, the physical courage, and the knowledge of that this was the right and just way to go forward, impressed me a lot. And I believed that if I supported this process, that I had to be willing to be able to engage in that. Since the early 70s, I have been a target of COINTELPRO, though I can't show you any documents because I can't get any papers. But I think that the U.S. government, that number one, they fear revolution, they fear a change in the status, and they fear the liberation of Black people, of Puerto Rico, of Native American people. They fear the breakup of the empire. They fear the loss of the wealth and power that the ruling class has here. And they fear the people who are committed to doing that. I have a 70-year sentence for participating in the liberation of Assata Shakur, support for the Black Liberation Struggle, in solidarity with the Black Liberation Army in various actions. It was called a conspiracy by the government, a criminal conspiracy. And I think because I was a white person who has been committed since 1968, perhaps, until now, and that no matter what they have done to me, the years in prison, the years in isolation, that I have not renounced that. I have never recanted that. Assata represents the strength and the spirit of the liberation of Black people's struggle for liberation in this country. And when that spirit, that representation of that spirit is freed, then there's hope. There's hope for Black people. There's hope for all people who love liberation and who love freedom. When I first went to prison in 1973, for several years I was with no other women political prisoners. So I sort of had to, it was like feeling my way. What is it to be a woman political prisoner? You know, what is the standard I should meet? So I think one of the most important things of being in prison, a privilege even, was that I met Lolita Lebron, one of the nationalist Puerto Rican prisoners. And she is truly an amazing woman, a woman who was willing to live, to die, to endure what it was ever necessary for the independence of her people, of her nation. And I learned an incredible amount about Puerto Rico and about the struggle for independence. And I think that, you know, really it's just mostly I feel privileged and honored to have been able to even been in prison with her, to have known her a little bit, and to have shared struggles and conversations and time with her. One of my favorite poems is a poem by Mario Benedetti, which is why it's called Why Do We Sing? Or you ask why we sing. And he says that we sing because it rains in the trenches and we are militants of life, and because we cannot or we will not let the song become ashes. And I think that if we're committed to struggle, that we're committed to life, and we're committed to that never dying. I believe in living. I believe in birth. I believe in the sweat of love and the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship steered by tired, seasick sailors can still be guided home to port.
Good evening, my name is Sophia Elijah. Thank you. Before I share my remarks, I want to share with you a very special message that arrived by a special post person. And I'm just going to read a brief excerpt from it. It is a message from Assata Shakur. A tribute to my sister. Like millions of young people, Marilyn Buck became a political activist during the 1960s. During that turbulent, groundbreaking decade, young people around the country felt motivated and empowered to fight for social and economic justice. The government reacted with brute force. Marilyn was one of those people who the government targeted. In 1985, she was arrested and charged with a variety of conspiracy cases. Among other charges, she was accused of conspiring to liberate me from prison. Marilyn was convicted of conspiracy and sentenced ultimately to 80 years in prison. I had the pleasure of meeting Marilyn. Our paths crossed somewhere in the whirlwind. She was one of the most committed, disciplined, and compassionate human beings that I have ever met. She was honest, critical, and energetic without the slightest trace of arrogance. She was smart, sensitive, and had an infinitely creative mind. She was a vegetarian and introduced me to some of the best vegetarian food I had ever eaten. She refused to be indifferent. She refused to ignore the pain of poverty or the evils of war and oppression. She did not wrap herself in a cloak of white-skinned privilege and practice deliberate blindness to the injustices of this world. Marilyn gave everything she had to the struggle for human liberation. In one of her poems, entitled Prayer, she wrote, "I pray that the predators perish, swallowed by their greed." And in another stanza, she went on to say, "I pray that the martyred and murdered rise in the light of the infant cradled smiles, rainbow chants, and morning hymns." I don't know when Marilyn's prayers will be answered, but I believe with all my heart that they will be. If human life is to survive, this planet must be freed from the evils of racism, oppression, exploitation, and war. The sacrifices that Marilyn made will not be forgotten. She took life seriously. She took struggle seriously, and she believed that people can and must make a difference. We love you, Marilyn. We thank you for your courage and commitment. We thank you for your inner beauty and your strength. Your energy and your spirit will be carried on. Asada Shakur, Havana, Cuba. In my work, I frequently do public speaking, and I train law students to try cases, and I always tell them they cannot work with notes. And so I ask all of you not to out me to my students, that I had so much anxiety about what I was going to say today that I knew I was going to have to work with notes. A little bit more than 25 years ago, I met a woman who forever changed my life. The word client and attorney first defined our relationship. I think that might have lasted about 24 hours. Various people cross our paths for a reason, and we don't always know why. But the reason for our paths crossing is abundantly clear. Not only did we become very dear friends, but we taught and learned from each other. Now let me be clear. I did not think I had anything to teach Marilyn. To me, she was probably one of the most worldly people I'd ever met. But in the days we shared after she was released, she took great care to tell me how much she had learned from me. I took great care to tell her I didn't think she should tell the government. Now, in our early years together, we were kind of finding our way as far as trying to decide just, you know, how are we going to work this thing out called attorney, client, friend, sisters. And one day she shared an anecdote with me that kind of sealed it for me. She was telling me about what the government agent said to her upon her capture. Of course, I'm hanging on every word because I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be a bunch of expletives. And Marilyn didn't curse a lot, so just hearing her share a bunch of expletives was going to be a special moment. And she went on to say that what the agent said to her was, no self-respecting white man would ever want to touch you. Now, hold on. What grabbed it for me was, her response was, well, I feel better now. So I knew we were off to a good start then. So I'm going to try to speed it up. I'm sure someone, I hope, will give me a time signal. But I want to share a few special things. One, early in her case in New York, the government was hell-bent on getting hair samples and blood samples from Marilyn and from Matulu. And we thought that was kind of quirky. What were they getting ready to do? Put together some kind of voodoo doll or something? But they really, you know, they were serious about it. And they had, before they even told us that they were requesting the samples, they had already gone to the judge and said that they wanted to be able to execute a force order, anticipating that Marilyn and Matulu would refuse to give up the hair and blood samples. And of course, they did refuse to give up the hair and blood samples, and the judge signed the force order. So, you know, this is pretty heavy stuff. I'm sitting in the attorney room with Marilyn and Matulu and, you know, the Judy Holmes and Jesse Berman and Shokwe Lumumba, and we're saying, so now, like, what are you guys going to do? Because, you know, coming for trial with broken bones and all bruised up, you know, that's just not cool. And they said, don't worry. Just get the judge to give you an order that it can all be videotaped. So I said, okay. But I kind of don't think that the guards and the marshals are going to stop from the royal ass-kicking just because they're on videotape. In fact, they kind of like that. Anyway, they said, we got the videotape order, and we go in, and Marilyn volunteers to be first. And they brought a few kind of hefty female marshals who, I guess, believed they were going to win. And Marilyn was shackled and handcuffed. And she kicked their ass. Okay? They could not get the hair or the blood samples. And I was dumbfounded. I didn't know that anybody could fight that well chained up. Well, the female marshals went out quickly defeated and got some of the male goons to come in. And I guess they sized up the situation and they doubled their numbers. And then they came in. Again, Marilyn put up a good fight, but she was totally outnumbered this time, and they succeeded in getting the samples. And then Matula was subjected to the same thing. So after it was all over, I figured that they would be pretty defeated and just wiped out. And they looked at each other and they said, we gave them a good one, didn't we? Now, I was a fairly young lawyer when I met Marilyn, and I was the junior lawyer in the team. Judy Holmes was senior counsel, and I was kind of learning my way through this first pretty big political case. So just before we were ready to start trial in her RICO conspiracy case, the government decides that they're going to do a dry run, and they want to try her for a smaller case, which was charging her with crossing state lines with a gun, being a felon. And that case was tried before Judge Rob Carter of the Southern District of New York, who many years later was actually considered to be the head of the NAACP. So Judge Carter was a very proper gentleman, and you know, we didn't have any issue with him, but you know, we had an issue with the state. So we didn't stand up for Judge Carter whenever he would come in the courtroom. But we'd always stood up for the jury because we were showing our solidarity with the people. So that was going pretty good. And you know, we got through the trial, it was a pretty short trial, and the jury was coming in for their verdict. So we stood up, and then Judge Carter came in and we sat down. And all of a sudden, Judge Carter said, is something wrong with your legs? So Judy, Marilyn, and I immediately turned around because we wanted to find out who in the spectators either had the gall to put their feet up on the rail or maybe had collapsed or fallen down. We thought something was really going on problematic in the spectators' spot. And as we turned around, Judge Carter said, don't turn around. I'm talking to you, Miss Holmes and Miss Elijah. If you don't want to spend some time in a cell next to Miss Buck, you better get up. Well, I had never heard that in court before. And I looked at Judy and I looked at Marilyn. I figured they would give me, you know, the guidance I needed since they'd been around the block a little longer than I did. And I caught Judy's eye first, and she gave me the nod like, so, okay, we're not going to move. We're going to stay in these seats. And Marilyn very calmly looked over at me and said under her breath, get up. You're no good to me in the cell next to me. Always a realist. You know, Ida said something earlier today about Marilyn loved black people. Truer words were never spoken. Very shortly after I became one of Marilyn's lawyers, several of the white left lawyers in New York came to me and said, we are so glad you agreed to be Marilyn's lawyer. And I'm like, oh no, it's an honor. I can't even believe she asked me to be her lawyer. And they said, oh, no, you don't have to understand. She won't do anything we tell her to do. But for you, she'll do everything you tell her to do. So I went. You know, I thought, oh, that can't be true. So I went into MCC to see Marilyn, and I shared that exchange with her, and she said, they got it right. What many of you may not know is that before July of 2010, Marilyn and I had had a plan to live together in New York for that had started up a few years earlier. At the time that she decided she wanted to change her parole location to New York City, she told me, I want to live in New York, but I want to live in the black community. So I kind of smiled and laughed and said, so why are you telling me? And she's like, don't be funny, Sophia. I want to live in the black community. Let's find a place in the black community to live. So we were going to get a brownstone, and we were going to take the first floor of it and make it a repository for all of the voluminous documents that had been created over the years about political prisoners. We knew that there were many lawyers who had represented political prisoners who really didn't want to haul those boxes around with them anymore, myself included. And we knew that there were many political prisoners who were kind of, you know, couldn't have but so many papers in their cell, so they might find that to be a safe place to be. And then we said, we'll create a job for Marilyn. She'll be the curator of all of this paper. So that was all going to be fine. So we started studying the real estate section of the New York Times every Sunday, with her studying it in Dublin and me studying it on the East Coast. And then she would send me these cryptic messages with a little cutout about this big of an announcement about some piece of property that I should go check out, and then a little notation every time, don't forget, we, capital we, want a garden, so look at places with a backyard. Okay. Well, though we didn't get a chance to get the garden or the backyard, we did get a chance to go across the street to the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens the day after she was released, take pictures, smell the flowers, and really enjoy that first full day of freedom. The day I got the news that Marilyn was going to get out, she had called me earlier in that day, but I didn't know for sure what day it was going to be, and I didn't want to tell her the news until I had it absolutely certain. So I asked her for the first time in all the 25 years we've known each other if she would call me back in a few hours. And so she said, okay. She didn't question it. And so she did call back around 5:30 that afternoon, and I was so excited. So I said, hey, Marilyn, are you sitting down? And she says, well, no, Sophia, I'm lying down. Remember, I don't feel well. Okay, you're lying down, right? Yes, I'm lying down. What is it, Sophia? I said, Marilyn, next Thursday, you're coming home. And the call dropped. And I couldn't believe it. And so for 30 painful minutes, I had to wait until she called back. And I'm thinking, she must be freaking out. 30 minutes later, the phone rings, and the phone call starts as it had always done for years. Hi, Sophia. This is Marilyn, as if I didn't know. And she says, let's start that over again. Now, what exactly did you say? And say it slowly. So I said, you're coming home next Thursday. So she said, I think I'll be packed. Marilyn had many friends, so many who wanted to visit her while she was in Carswell. And unfortunately, because of prison laws and restrictions that are draconian, backwards, and I could probably think of a few other choice words to describe them, so many people were not allowed to visit her. And the same held true after she was released on parole because of those same restrictions. Many people who loved and adored her could not come to see her. But they were able to share their love in so many other ways. And so the postman had a new job, privately delivering tons of packages, letters, and well wishes to our Brooklyn home on a daily basis because things were coming from all over the country. Now, we also got to do some other fun things. We got to take a joyride around Harlem. Now, not exactly a joyride, but Gemma's sister, Ona Merkinson, and I had to take Marilyn to her doctor's appointment up at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. And afterwards, I said, so how are you feeling? Do you think you're up for a little driving around? So she said, sure, I think I can do that. And so we drove all around Harlem when I showed her different places, and then we drove down the FDR Drive. And around Brooklyn some, and she was really soaking it all up. And so we got back to the house, and she didn't say anything really about the experience. So that evening, we're having dinner, and so I said, so, you know, Marilyn, what did you think? I mean, New York looks really different, right? That's what I thought she was going to comment on. And she says, well, you know, Sophia, what really struck me from that experience is your driving is pretty cavalier. And I said, wait a minute. You're the one that's been charged with being a getaway driver, not me. What do you mean my driver's cavalier? One of the things that was really important to Marilyn that she loved about her freedom was the ability to eat anything she wanted, anytime she wanted, and to have it fixed for her. So Gemma experienced some of this. Now, she loved the fact that you could order takeout food, and they would actually arrive fairly quickly, and what arrived was actually what you ordered. And that in my neighborhood, if you ordered $10 worth or more of food, it would be delivered. Now, she was a little put off about the fact that food actually would cost 10 whole dollars, but we got her to get past that. But one night, each day she would share with us her menu, what she wanted for that day. And so one day she said she wanted sweet potato. So Gemma and I got really excited. So we buzzed around the corner to the Key Foods and got sweet potato, or probably Gemma did, and I stayed back and did something. But anyway, sweet potatoes arrived, and we boiled up the sweet potato, and I think we might have had some debate whether or not we should put a little bit of honey on it so it'd be extra sweet. And we were very, very pleased to deliver this sweet potato because it was a big deal to be able to provide her with whatever it was she wanted to eat. So we deliver the sweet potato, and then we look like, you know, something magical is going to come out of this dish. And so she takes a few bites, and we're expecting a big smile, and she says, you didn't put any onions in it? I'm like, onions? Who in the heck puts onions in sweet potatoes? So that's when I knew it really was a good idea that in that brownstone, we were going to have separate units and separate kitchens. Okay? One more anecdote. Most of you probably heard the wonderful but all too brief interview that Marilyn did a few days after she was released that was aired on Africa Today. She had a lot of trepidation leading up to that radio interview. And then she actually tried to talk herself out of doing the radio interview and tried to get Barbara Zeller and myself to kind of agree with that. So we're sitting in the dining room, and she's saying, well, I don't know what I should say. I don't know what people want to hear. I said, they want to hear your voice, okay? You can say Hiccup and Wild Bill Rogers. It'll be okay. She says, well, no, I think I should say something a little bit more important. Yes, of course you should. So she says, you know, really, Walter Turner ought to interview some of the people who are still inside. And I said, no, people want to hear from you, Marilyn. I mean, this is a big deal that you're out. And she says, you know, I really don't think I'm particularly historically significant. And Barbara and I were speechless. And then I fell out of the chair laughing. I said, what do you mean you're not particularly historically significant? There's a lot of soul white members of the Black Liberation Army rolling around getting ready to get on the radio, okay? Of course you're historically significant, and you better figure out what you're going to say because that call is coming in a few minutes. And she looked at us like, you're pressuring me. I'm not historically significant. But that was a testament to her humility and the fact that she wanted to believe that she shouldn't have to have been historically significant, that there were many Marilyn Bucks in the world, and it pained her that there were not. The day before Marilyn passed away, I had to go up to Boston to get a file and come right back to New York, and I was really too tired to drive. So we all agreed I would go by public transportation. So Marilyn asked me if I was going to fly, and I was like, absolutely not. Nobody, I can't afford to fly. She said, well, then you're going to take the train. I said, no, I'm going to take the Chinatown bus. So she said, well, why don't you take the train? It's so much more comfortable. You'll be able to relax, stretch out. I said, well, let me put it to you like this. The train is $65 one way. The bus is $15 one way. Without a blink, she said, "Sophia, you may take the bus." My friendship with Marilyn outlived a lot of other experiences in my life. Outlived my marriage, subsequent relationships, several jobs, numerous apartments, multiple hairstyles, a few cars, many presidents, menopause for both of us, a few operations for her, weight loss and weight gain, and several concerning fashion shifts. But our friendship also experienced the loss of many dear comrades: Kwesi Balogun, Noah Washington, Richard Williams, Bashir Hamid, Teddy Jaheed, Merle Africa, Safia Bukhari, Janet Cyril, Susan Burnett, Nandi Majid, Nubia Lumumba, John Bowman, Wayne Thompson, Javad, Lolita, who passed just 2 days before Marilyn, and then she was gone. Gone from this physical plane, but her spirit permeates everything we do. After all, who else could get everybody up at 5 o'clock in the morning to meditate but Marilyn? One of the things that Marilyn wanted to do upon her release was play Scrabble. In fact, she started selling wolf tickets about Scrabble defeats she planned for people early before she got out. Well, we never got to play Scrabble together because her illness prevented her from maintaining such prolonged periods of concentration. But in her honor, I downloaded Scrabble on my iPhone so that whenever I have a few spare moments, she plays from her vantage point and I play from mine, and she's been winning. For about 5 days during Marilyn's 20 days of freedom, she had to be hospitalized in a hospice. And she took with her her cell phone, her laptop computer, and her iPod Touch. And she was busy delving into IT and electronic bliss every spare moment that the nurses were not checking some vital sign. One morning, I looked across the room, and there she was on her computer having a good time responding to text to email messages. So I sent her a little text message. I said, "My dear sister, friend, and comrade, thank you for allowing me to share these past cherished 25 years together." Something nice and mushy and deep, right? She writes back, "Ditto, love, love, later, later." And and goes back to her email messages. Such was the joy of the journey of life with Marilyn. The day before she passed, she was able to enjoy a very special treat. A recorded message arrived by special post, and it was played for her by Gemma. And now you're going to hear that special message. Thank you.
That was Sophia Elijah. The third segment of this program will begin with a voice message from Asada Shakur to Marilyn. For more information on Marilyn, go to the webpage of Friends of Marilyn Buck at marilynbuck.com. This program was recorded by Jeffrey Blankford. I'm Mariah Gillarden. Thank you for listening.